You know, Professor Rogers was speaking earlier about how activism in the environmental and animal law areas has become increasingly criminalized. There's another problem that that has occurred, however, and that's the use of civil suits to attempt to stifle legitimate political debate and concern. Some of these, for example, you may have heard of slap suits, strategic lawsuits against public participation, and the use of the civil courts to shut down alternate voices and viewpoints. And our next speaker, Mr. Howard Lyman, is going to talk about one of his experiences that was actually pretty well known and publicized, but he's going to give us the straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak. So, Mr. Howard Lyman.
You should never applaud for somebody until you hear what they have to say. My name is Howard Lyman. I'm a fourth-generation farmer, rancher, feedlot operator. I travel around the world about 300 days a year, and I talk to people about the proper amount of animal products to have in their diet as being zero. People look at me and they say, wait a minute. Fourth-generation farmer, rancher, feedlot operator talking about not eating animal products? You must be smoking the number one crop out of California. Only test for the Supreme Court that I can pass. But I was raised in Montana during the Second World War. My parents had the largest dairy farm in Montana. Couldn't hire any help, and so my mother and father were both milking cows. That meant that my brother, two sisters, and I were raised by my grandparents. And back then, daycare is much different than it is today. No such thing as swing slides and Lego blocks back then. Daycare was working in the garden. My first job, 4 or 5 years old, was working in the garden. I thought it was the Garden of Eden. I thought it was the greatest thing in the world. The only thing I ever wanted to be in my life was a farmer. Birds, trees, living soil. It was like dying and going to heaven. So I went to school, and for me, school was a party. I looked at it and said, I know what I'm going to be the rest of my life. My parents have a farm. I'm going to be a farmer. There's nothing in school that is of any interest to me other than partying and playing football. I guarantee you I never missed a party. I never missed a football game. And believe it or not, I never took a book home in 12 years of school. My senior year, they came to me and they said, Lyman, you're going to graduate. Almost had the big one right there. Couldn't hardly believe it. You think, I had trouble believing it. Can you imagine what it was like for my instructors? Lyman's going to graduate. I figured it out. They looked at it and they said, you know, as dumb as that guy is, if we don't graduate him, he may come back. They didn't want to take a chance on that, so they graduated me. I was thrilled to death. I went home on that farm, and I found that that farm was a business to be run. I didn't have the tools to run a business. I was dumber than a post. I didn't let that bother me any because I wanted to be an agribusinessman. Now, I couldn't spell it, but I knew that's what I wanted to be. So I decided I would go to Montana State University, and I would get a degree in agriculture. I went there. I learned a thing that was called better living through chemistry. I couldn't hardly believe it. I went there. I got a degree in agriculture. I went home and I said to my father, I said, hey, Pop, move over. We're going to take this one-horse farm and we're going to turn it into an agribusiness. And he looked at me and he said, now what in the world is that? I said, did you not ever hear about better living through chemistry? And he said, no, our job is to work with nature. I said, no, that's old-fashioned. The new way to feed a hungry world is herbicides, pesticides, hormones, and medication. I said, just stand back and watch my smoke. I'm going to turn this one-horse farm into an agribusiness. And over a period of years, I turned it into an operation where I had 7,000 head of cattle, 12,000 acres of crop, 30 employees. I can't tell you what a thrill it was the first time I wrote a check for $1 million, and it didn't bounce. And I thought, man, I have arrived. I am the Donald Trump of agriculture. Well, just when I was on top of the world, I got a wake-up call. I ended up paralyzed from the waist down. Doctor told me, he said, you have a tumor on your spinal cord. If that tumor is on the inside of the cord, you have less than one chance in a million you'll ever walk again. Somebody gives you the odds of one in a million. What they're saying to you is, hey, sucker, pick out the wheelchair you like. You're going to be in it the rest of your life. I'm laying in the hospital. A lot of things going through my mind. It's not about having 7 combines at $100,000 apiece or 20 tractors or 30 trucks. What was going through my mind is why I became a farmer. Birds and trees and living soil. I saw the birds die, the trees die, I saw the soil change. And it was not until I was paralyzed I was willing to admit I was the problem, not the solution. That night, you think that you'd be laying there thinking about, you know, hey, Lord, let me talk to you. Let's make a deal. But the fact is, the only thing I could think about was I'd be in a wheelchair the rest of my life. I wonder what kind of an invalid I will be. Will I be in a wheelchair feeling sorry for myself? Or can I actually make my life amount to something? And if I do that, what's that something going to be? I decided that night, no matter what, I would spend the rest of my life trying to get that farm back to what it was when I was a kid with birds, trees, and living soil. They operated on me for 12 hours. Sure enough, they opened up my spinal column. I had a tumor on the inside of the spinal cord. They cut the covering on the cord. Not only was the tumor on the spinal cord, it was under the cord. They could not lift the cord up to get the tumor. All they could do was pick a nerve and cut it, hope the tumor was attached like a fish on a line. They cut one, they took out a tumor the size of my thumb. I walked out of the hospital with a 1 in a million operation. The day I walked out of the hospital, I never again worried any about having more combines or more tractors or more land or more cattle. But I didn't know what the answer was. I went to my doctor and I said to him, what caused the tumor? He said it was adolescent cells stimulated to grow, probably by the chemicals used on the farm. Not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but all of a sudden I decided we needed to become organic farmers. I went and saw my banker. I said to my banker, I said, I need to borrow some money. I want to start farming with nature. My banker reared back in his chair and he said, what does that mean? I said, I want to become an organic farmer. My banker, he looked at me and he laughed. He said, you want me to lend you money? You're not going to spend it with my other customers, the chemical dealer, the pharmaceutical dealer, the fertilizer dealer? He said, there will never be a day like that. And so 1983, I sold my farm, I paid my debts, and I started working with other farmers not to make the mistakes that I made. I got a call. They said, how would you like to go to Washington, D.C. and work on Capitol Hill? I can remember looking up and saying, oh, thank you, Lord. 535 members of Congress, I just absolutely knew they wanted to do what was right. You remember nothing else that I say today. I'd like you to remember what I learned 5 years working on Capitol Hill. I learned a thing that was called the golden rule. Them that got the gold make the rules. And I said to my friends after 5 years, I said, you know, this game is rigged. The deck is marked. We will never win in Washington, D.C. And they looked at me and they said, what are you going to do? Go talk to the people? I said, yeah. They said, you're never going to get half of the people to do anything. I said, we don't need half. 50 or 80% of the people are brain dead. They're part of the herd. They're following nose to tail. And when they follow nose to tail, there's only one thing they see in front of them. Our job is to educate the 20% that are still thinking. And when the majority of the 20% that are thinking decide where to go, the herd will follow. So I left Washington, D.C. I started going out and talking to people. Now, and in this process, here I am. I was one of the first 300-pound football players in North America. When I quit playing football, I kept eating the same way. I got well over 300 pounds. My blood pressure was sky high. My cholesterol was over 300. I'd sit down and have lunch, and my nose would bleed. I knew I was in trouble. But I came from Montana. I'd rather be caught riding a stolen horse than admitting to somebody I was thinking about becoming a vegetarian. But I figured it out. I became a closet vegetarian. I didn't tell anybody. 1 year, I'm a vegetarian. I lose some weight. My blood pressure goes down slightly. My cholesterol goes down slightly. I thought, wow, if I can do that being the world's worst vegetarian, just think what I could do as a vegan, and I could spell vegan. I became a vegan. I lost 130 pounds. My blood pressure went from sky high to normal. My cholesterol from 300 to 135. The longest ongoing heart study in the world, the Framingham study, has shown that over 40 years, not one person has had a heart attack that had a cholesterol reading below 150. My God, I got the answer. I can't hardly wait to share it with my friends, my family. My wife and I have been married for over 40 years. Not one time in 40 years have I ever regretted marrying my wife. Now, she has, but I married much better than she did. But she did come with a mother that in over 40 years has been a severe test. And I've got the answer. And I'm thinking about, am I going to tell my mother-in-law about my new diet, even though it has the potential to extend her life? I thought about it for a long time, and I thought it was the right thing to do, and I picked up the phone, and I called my mother-in-law, and I said, hey, Marge, how would you like to come to our house for Thanksgiving dinner? And she said, you won't have any turkey. I said, I'll tell you what, if you and Ralph will come to my house for Thanksgiving dinner, I guarantee you we'll have turkey. She knew she had me eating crow. Thanksgiving Day, my mother-in-law walked in the house immediately to the oven. She opened up the oven, no turkey. She looked in the refrigerator, no turkey. To be sure, she checked the dryer, no turkey. Well, I had guaranteed her we'd have turkey. I took my mother-in-law by the hand. Fortunately, I was wearing my gloves. I took her to the back door, I opened up the back door, and in the backyard I had a live turkey. I gave my mother-in-law an axe. Not a real good idea to give your mother-in-law an axe. And I told her, I said, if you want turkey, you got to kill it. Now, I have good news and bad news. The good news is the turkey's still alive. The bad news, so's my mother-in-law. But, you know, I learned something. People did not want you to point at them and say, let me tell you what you want to eat. You'd see their eyes roll up. You could hear their ears shut. And here I am traveling around the world. I'm talking to people about diet. And all of a sudden, I think about it and I think, you know, why don't we talk about one of the basic problems? We were grinding up cows and turning them into feed and feeding them back to other cows. There's over 100,000 cows in the United States of America today that are fine at night, dead in the morning. They round them up, grind them up, turn them into feed, and feed them back to other cows. In England, they're having the problem with mad cow disease, and I thought, you know, what we ought to do is we ought to educate people here in North America not to do what they've done in England. And so I went out and started talking to people about bovine spongiform encephalopathy. If you can say that, you're an authority. And so I'm talking to them about not feeding cows to cows, because of something that affects the brain, that eats holes in the brain, that is 100% fatal, that will incubate from anywhere from 10 to 40 years, 100% fatal. People looked at me like I was the one that had holes in their brain, my brain, because they had never heard of it before. Well, I was going to England, and I was going to testify in the McLeibel trial. It was the longest-going suit between a major corporation and an individual for libel. They asked me if I would come to England and testify as an expert witness. And so I said to them, I said, you want me to come to England testify? And they said, yeah. I said, will you provide me a plane ticket? You know, my relatives came from England in 1635, and so I wanted to go and figure out why they left. I said, would you send me a plane ticket? They said, no. I said, well, would you get me a place to stay? They said, no. I said, would you feed me while I'm there? They said, no. Well, under a deal like that, I could not turn it down. So I went to England. I testified in the trial, and believe it or not, the Minister of Health stood in front of Parliament and said, we no longer can assure the English people that mad cow disease cannot be transferred from cows to humans. I was the only person in England from the United States that was willing to talk on the issue, and I did 70 press events in 9 days. My hotel. They turned the breakfast room into a press gallery, set up the cameras. I did an interview. I went out, and I had a limo waiting for me to take me down to BBC to do World Service Tonight. And believe it or not, this limo pulls up to the door of the hotel. A guy jumps out in a blue suit and a limber driver's hat, and he opens the door for me. I told him, I said, if you ever do that again, I'll break your arm. I'm a farm boy. I can open the door all by myself. We go down to BBC. I walk in. The producer is there. And I said to the producer, I said, wow, how many stations is this on? He said, I don't know, but we're in 214 countries. Wow. I did an hour on 214 countries. I went from being a farm boy to a celebrity. My next event was BBC television. I went outside. My limo was waiting. My driver did not open the door for me. I get in. BBC television is directly across the street. We did a U-turn. And I said to him, I said, hell, I could have walked over here. Did an hour on BBC television. Went back to my hotel. 7 newspapers waiting to interview me. It was like this for 9 days. I got on a plane. I came back to JFK Airport. I'm walking down the runway, and over the loudspeaker, I heard Howard Lyman pick up a white paging telephone. Well, being a celebrity, I looked to my entourage. I was alone. I answered the phone. It was Oprah Winfrey. Oprah said, how would you like to come to Chicago and appear on a show? We're going to do a show. It's called Dangerous Food. Could it happen here? Now, do you think I was going to jump at the opportunity to appear on television in front of a few million people? Being a celebrity, I waited a good 4 or 5 seconds before I agreed. Oprah sent me a ticket. I flew to Chicago. I get off of the airplane, I'm walking down the runway, and here's a guy in a blue suit and a limo driver's hat and a big sign, and the sign said, Lyman. I went up to him and I said, could you wait a few minutes? I want to find somebody with a camera. I want to get a picture of this. The guy said, no. Took me out and put me in a limo. That limo was so long, I had a phone to talk to the driver. I was embarrassed. Luckily, the windows were frosted. He took me down and put me in a hotel that was larger than the home I was raised in. My parents, 2 sisters and a brother. Next morning, I'm up bright and early. I got my suit on. I go down. My limo is waiting for me. I go and I meet Oprah Winfrey for the first time. I walk in the door. Oprah comes up to me and she says, you know, I saw the movie Babe 5 times. I will never again eat pork. I looked up and said, Lord, it's going to be a great day. I'm in the green room. Every one of you guys in here, if you're going to go on television in front of a few million people, sitting in the green room, it's your wife's responsibility to pick up the phone, call you up and tell you exactly what to say. The phone rings. It's my wife. She tells me what to say. I'm thinking about it. They come and get me and take me out and put me on the stage. To the right of me, a grandmother from England whose granddaughter's dying in the human form of mad cow disease. To the left of me, a guy from the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. Going through my mind is what my wife said to me. She said to me, remember, don't say anything stupid. I'm sitting there trying to figure out if there is a comma in that sentence or not. Listen, you guys are lawyers. You're supposed to be up on that. Along comes Oprah Winfrey. She looks at me and points at me and says, here's a man who believes. Within 10 years, we could have a disease that would make AIDS look like the common cold. And I said, absolutely. Oprah said, that's a strong statement. I said, Oprah, we have 100,000 cows a year, fine at night, dead in the morning. We round them up, grind them up, turn them into feed, and feed them back to other cows. We collect roadkill, deer, elk, possum, raccoons, grind them up, turn them into feed, and feed them back to cows. And then we take euthanized pets, dogs and cats, full of chemicals that were used to kill them. We grind them up, turn them into feed, and feed those back to our food animals. Oprah's eyes are as big as saucers. I know I got her. She turns around and looks at the guy from the National Cattlemen's Beef Association and says, Dr. Weber, are we feeding cows to cows? I never forget what he had to say. There's a limited amount of that going on. Near as I can tell, 95% of all the animals fed in factory feedlots are eating the remains of other animals. And then the next thing out of Oprah's mouth gets a suit. She said, that just stops me cold. I will never again eat a burger. Now, she didn't say, you shouldn't eat a burger. She didn't say, I think the meat's infected. She just said, that stops me cold. I will never again eat a burger. Now, before I went on the Oprah show, I called a friend of mine who is an attorney here in Seattle. I'll have you know that that's where the top of the line attorneys are. I asked her, I said, I'm going on the Oprah show. I'm going to talk about, dangerous food. How about this food disparagement law? She said, let me look into it. I'll give you a call back. She called me back and she said, the food disparagement law is very simple. It is against the statute if you say something you know to be false about a perishable commodity. Hell, that's fine. I didn't plan on going on the Oprah show and saying anything I knew to be false. I wasn't even worried about it. I was just going to go and tell the truth. So I did. As soon as the show was over, we were taping it. You know, it took about 2 hours to tape the show. As soon as it was over, I went up to Oprah and I said to her, I said, Oprah, why don't you give me 10 minutes? I'll get you off of chicken. Oprah looked at me and said, only one animal a day. So I went about my business. I wasn't worried. I knew that I hadn't violated the food disparagement law. And lo and behold, a group of Texas cattlemen sued Oprah, Harpo Production, and myself under the food disparagement law in Texas. We're going to be tried in Amarillo, Texas. I don't know how many of you have been to Amarillo, Texas, but if you're going to give the world an enema, you send the hose to Amarillo, Texas. I go to Amarillo. After USDA and FDA did exactly what I called for, they banned the feeding of cows, sheep, and goats to cows. I thought, we'd go down there. The judge, a 72-year-old lady, a tough old heifer, we thought, would go down there and the judge would dismiss the case. I go down there. I think it's going to be a vacation. I get down there and whoa, the largest employer in Amarillo is a slaughter facility killing cattle. Bumper stickers all over town said the only mad cow in Texas is named Oprah. I knew we were in trouble. I went to my attorney and I said to him, we need a change of venue. We go and see the judge. She's a tough one, I'll tell you. And we said to her, Your Honor, we'd like a change of venue. She picked up the hammer, slapped it down, and said, motion denied. Bring in the jury pool. 140 people walked in the courtroom. You never saw so many hats, boots, and belt buckles in all your life. I knew we were in trouble. I leaned over to my attorney and I said, we might as well write the appeal today. We're never going to prevail here in Amarillo. At the end of the day, it's not like Perry Mason. I mean, you don't know everything about every juror that's there. The judge, oh, what an interview she gave him. She said, is anybody here that's involved in the industry of grinding up cows and feeding them to cows? Nobody raised a hand. She says, is there anybody here that has a relative that's involved in doing that? And almost every hand in the jury pool went up. And I thought, well, she's going to cut all of them out. She said, can you all have an open mind? Oh, every hand went up. We have nine challenges. What we knew about the jury, believe it or not, we had one lady on the jury. Her brother was selling the equipment to the feedlots that was placing the ground-up cows in the ration. And they thought it was unreasonable when we ruled her out. Anyway, at the end of the day, we had 12 jurors, absolutely steeped in the culture. I knew we were in trouble. And I said to my attorney, I said, what do we do now? And he said, I have good news and bad news. I said, what's the good news? He said, we have a jury. I said, what's the bad news? He said, they're going to put you on the stand tomorrow. He said, I'll tell you right now. He said, the first question they're going to ask you, is it not true that you are a vegetarian? I said, I can handle that. He said, you damn well better or we're going to lose. Sure enough, I'm on the stand the next day. The plaintiff's attorney is looking at me, and he's snickering and giggling, and he's looking at the jury, and he finally says, I can't hardly say it, but Mr. Lyman, is it not true that you are a vegetarian? I looked at the jury and said, I will not deny that has saved my life. And the jury is sitting there nodding their head, and never again in that trial did they ask me about being a vegetarian. But they asked me every question you can imagine. I'm on the stand. The plaintiff's attorney is looking at me, and he says, Mr. Lyman, has anybody ever called you irresponsible? I said, yes. My attorney's sitting over there going, no, no, no. The plaintiff's attorney, it's like he found the key to the Gordian knot. He's thrilled to death. He says, who? I look at the jury and said, my wife. The jury sitting there has been there, done that. So we're going through all of this. And finally, after days, I get off of the stand. But remember, the trial took 6 weeks. You can't imagine the stuff that we went through. Now, many of you probably have an idea who Dr. Phil is. Dr. Phil happened to work for Oprah and myself. I paid half of his salary. Oprah paid the other half. Let me tell you, you're thinking about becoming a lawyer? Look at doing courtroom services. Pays a lot better. Oprah's lawyer is a guy by the name of Chip Babcock, probably the finest attorney that I've ever seen. The guy is just absolutely unbelievable. All of the cases that he ever tried, he only lost one. And the amazing thing, he lost it about a guy that faked his own death to collect his insurance. And Chip actually found him in prison in Spain and videotaped him. And the guy that was being sued, that Chip was defending, was from a television station. And he was such an ass that even though the jury found that what he was talking about was true, they convicted him because he made such an ass out of himself in the trial. And so Chip gives me a videotape. And he says, I don't want to tell you what to do, but I want to show you what not to do. And it was an amazing thing. So we go through the trial. It was rather important that after the Oprah show, the Board of Trade, the futures market, dropped astronomically. And so they claim that it was because of the Oprah show that it cost millions of dollars, and we were being sued for $180 million. Now, there's a couple of things I know about the law. First thing about the law is never sue anybody who has nothing. That's me. Second rule of law, never sue anybody that talks to millions of people a day. That's Oprah. But they're suing us, and so they want to prove that this show that we did is what brought the market down. And remember that the Oprah show, at the time that the Board of Trade is open, the only place in the world that it is shown at the time the Board of Trade is open is Chicago. Nowhere else. Nobody else saw it. In Los Angeles or New York or Miami, anywhere, as long as the Board of Trade was open, but they all saw it afterwards. But they were claiming that everybody decided to sell because they saw the Oprah show, but the fact of it is, they never saw it until afterwards. So anyway, they brought in a guy from the Chicago Board of Trade, put him on the stand, and they said to him, how long have you been on the Board of Trade and worked there? And the guy says, 35 years. They said, what do you think caused the drop in the futures market? And he looked over and he said, it was Howard Lyman and Oprah Winfrey. That's what caused the market to drop. So the judge, she works from 9 to 5. We start promptly at 9, and we quit exactly at 5. This guy, about 4 o'clock, is turned over to Chip. Chip said to him, what caused the futures market to drop? And the guy said, it was Howard Lyman and Oprah Winfrey. He said, it wouldn't happen to be high grain prices. And the guy said, absolutely not. It was Oprah Winfrey and Howard Lyman. Well, the night before, we were sitting there, and it was about midnight, and Chip was saying, you know, this guy is going to testify tomorrow. I've seen him somewhere before. We pick up the phone. We call a television station. The producer of the show in Chicago, and we said to her, would you go down and pull the tape and see whether you have an interview with this guy? Now, I'm telling you, she is one mad heifer, and she just doesn't want any part of that at midnight. And she finally says, well, I'll do it, but I sure don't like it. She goes down, and sure enough, this guy had done an interview the day of the Oprah drop in the market. So we're getting close to 5 o'clock, where Chip is talking to this guy, and said to him, he said, you're sure that it was Oprah Winfrey and Howard Lyman that caused the drop in the market, it was not high grain prices. The guy said, absolutely, no doubt about it. Chip looks up at the judge, and it's about 4 minutes to five. And he said, Your Honor, I'd like to run a short video. The judge looks at her watch and says, how long is it going to take? He said, 30 seconds. She said, go ahead. So he puts it on. Here's this guy being interviewed the day of the Oprah drop outside of the Board of Trade in Chicago. They got a microphone stuck in his face, and they said to him, what caused the drop in the market today? And the guy said, it was high grain prices. Oprah said, Chip said, maybe the jury would like to see that again. And so they queued it up again and played it. Said, what caused the market to drop? This guy says, high grain prices. It's 5 o'clock. Chip says, this is Friday night. Chip says to the judge, I have no further questions. The jury went home that night in their mind, and the guy on television, the trial was over at that point. So we come back on Monday. They no longer want to talk about the Chicago Board of Trade. That's out of there. But you remember that the food disparagement law, it's about saying something that affects a perishable product. So the plaintiffs finish their case. Our side gets up, and we said to the honor, we would like you to dismiss the case. And she said, under what grounds? She said, well, we're being sued under the perishable, or that the product is perishable, and every one of the people that are suing us are cattlemen, and they only have live cattle. They do not have a meat market, they don't have a butcher shop, and we don't think that the people that are suing us had any perishable commodity, because they were alive the day before the show, they were alive the day of the show, and they were alive the day after the show. And the judge says, we will recess for a day. We're looking at it and saying, oh, my God, can you imagine? He may throw this case out. She may actually go and look at it and say, the food disparagement law only deals with perishable commodities, and these guys that are suing don't have perishable commodities. So she has the right. She has the case law to actually throw this out. So I'm telling you, the day we're sitting around waiting for the judge to make her decision, I'm not real religious, but I did what I could to reestablish firm connections with the man upstairs, or woman, whatever she is. And we come back the next morning, and the judge says, I have decided that we are throwing out the food disparagement law. He says the defendants are exactly right. It does not cover. And I'm sitting there saying, ha, it's over now. And she said, but I am allowing the trial to go forward under libel and slander. Oh. But you know, it was an interesting thing. To be found liable or liable in slander, you have to know the individual that you libeled or slandered. We never heard of these guys. I had no idea in the world where they came from. And so we went through another 3 weeks of trial, basically implanting in the jury the idea that nobody on our side, not one individual in Harpo Production, not one individual associated with Oprah, not myself or my wife, had ever heard of these people. And after 6 weeks, the trial case was sent to the jury. While we're waiting for the jury to come back, the first thing I will tell you is, if you want to know how long a jury's going to be out, calculate how many meals they can get between the time the judge gives them the case and by the time they render the verdict. I think it's much more important about what they're having for dinner than anything else. They finally come back and they find Oprah, Harpo Production, and myself not liable. You know, I'm thrilled to death. I am no longer, this is little over 3 years that we've been paying attorneys, fighting this case, and so I'm ready to get it over. The cattlemen turn around immediately after the verdict, finding Oprah, Harpo, myself not liable. They turn around and appealed it to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans. We're in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals for a year. They come back with a unanimous panel decision that Oprah, Harpo Production, and myself are not liable. And then in their opinion, they said, everything that Lyman said on the show was true, and the truth is not actionable. Wow! I'm thrilled to death. The cattlemen immediately ask for a rehearing. It's denied. And then they turn around and sue us in state court. And Texas has an archaic law on the books that says that if you have a plaintiff that is from the state of the defendant, you can be sued in state court in Texas. They had a plaintiff from Illinois, where Oprah lived, but they did not have a plaintiff from Virginia, where I was living, and so I moved for the case to go back from state court to federal court. We're right in front of the judge that we just spent 6 weeks in her courtroom. Oprah looked at it and said, hey, that's the bus I want to be on, so she was able to move her portion of the case with mine in front of the same judge, and 6 years after we did the show, the judge, the 70, not 72 anymore, this gal is 77 now, still a tough old heifer, finally threw out the case with prejudice, which meant they could not refile it. The statute of limitations had run out. But I want to talk to you about the law. Remember, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals said everything that Lyman said was true and the truth is not actionable. Is there anybody in here today that believes that's true? An amazing thing. When they passed the Patriot Act, there was a thing in the Patriot Act that was called the Animal Enterprise Terrorist Act. In the Animal Enterprise Terrorist Act, if I did exactly the same thing today that I did in the Oprah show in 1996, I would be guilty, because the Animal Enterprise Terrorist Act says anybody that says anything, even though it's true, that causes the drop in the price of an animal product, you are in violation of the statute. What the hell do you think the founders of this country would think if they knew that you could not stand up and speak to the truth? We've known for a long time that you cannot be in a theater and yell fire. But you can turn the lights on and go up on the stage and talk to the people about what to do if there is a fire. Do you think you cannot go and talk to the American people about the problems associated with eating animals that are being fed the ground up remains of other animals, that are eating dogs and cats that are full of the chemicals that were used to kill them. The fact of it is you can't do that today under the Patriot Act the way it's written today. What I'm saying to you is you're going to spend your career in the field of law. And right now, I will tell you that the law is the only thing that we have left for the American people. Is there anybody here that believes that the Congress is free and open and committed to the American people? Is there anybody here that thinks the administration is more concerned about anything other than being re-elected? The law is the only thing that we have left. And that means that we have to have people in the law that are willing to stand up and go against the tradition that's out there. Look at what happened yesterday. The Supreme Court came out and said the corporations now can spend whatever they want. I happen to live in Ellensburg, and you know what the Ellensburg paper said? The Supreme Court came out with great news for American labor unions. They can spend all of the money they want now. And they never talked about Coca-Cola or Monsanto or any of the others, but it was the labor unions were given free rein. What in the hell is going on? When are we going to wake up to the fact that the losers in all of this are the American people? We're not going to cure it. Look at what happened in Congress. We had 60 Democratic votes. They couldn't even get their act together to pass health care, where 89% of Americans supported single payer. Do you realize they never even had a person at the panel that was talking about single payer and all of the solutions that were there? And 89% of Americans think that's the way if we should do it? I spent 5 years working on Capitol Hill, and I will tell you right now, I didn't know all 535 members of Congress. But I knew well over 400 of them, and out of the 400 I knew, there was not 10 of them I'd have babysit my children. It is the worst group of bastards I've ever met in my life. But they're good compared to the Supreme Court. They're good compared to the administration, and I don't care whether we're talking about the Bush administration or the Obama administration. If we, as the American people at the grassroots, are not able to get legal representation that we can go and fight in court, which is the last bastion of democracy, we might as well be living in China. I feel that I have been the most fortunate individual in the world. I had the opportunity to work on Capitol Hill. I had the opportunity to run for Congress. I lost to a six-term incumbent by 4 percentage points. And people said to me, "Wow, you've got great name recognition. You should run again." And my wife told me, she said, "If you ever decide to run for public office again, you need to find a new wife." I have given up my political aspirations. But for me to sit in a courtroom, to see what was happening, and remember, in the Oprah case, as near as I can tell, there were over 40 lawyers working on both sides. We had over 1 million documents in the computer that were available to any attorney on our side within 10 to 12 seconds. It was nice to have somebody like Chip Babcock as the lead attorney. The guy is one of the best that I've ever seen. But everybody doesn't have that opportunity. But everybody should have that opportunity. We need to realize right here, right now, today, this is not about a new car. It's not about lakefront property. This is about the future for our children and grandchildren. And where is it going to come from? I am convinced that the only hope we have is in law. Where do you start? Right here, right now. Remember that if you do something you love, you will never work a day in your life. I am probably the most fortunate individual in the world because I do exactly what I want to do. I talk about what I think needs to be talked about. You know, I was sued for $188 million. You know what I had at the time? I had a 1996 Ford Taurus that was worth about $4,000. That is the only thing that I have in my ownership. So I go and I talk about the issues. I try to stimulate people to realize that you can make a difference. Chip Babcock, one of the best attorneys I've ever seen in my life. You know where he came from? He was a sports writer. And I'll never forget, we were doing depositions. And one of the attorneys from the other side was sitting there and he was talking to Chip. And we were waiting for something to happen, and this guy said to him, he said, "Chip, what did you do before you became a lawyer?" And Chip said, "Well, I was a sports columnist." The guy looked at him and said, "Oh, I'll talk real slow." And I will never forget when we had the guy on the stand. Chip turned him inside out, and he said to him, he said, "Do not worry, I will talk real slow." So what I'm saying to you today, you're on the threshold of what could be the most monumental thing for the United States of America. You're in the right place at the right time to do the right thing. I've used up an hour of your time. What I would like to do is open it up for questions and answers. If you have no questions, we will have a quiz.
You say the only thing is the law, and yet you acknowledge that at this point the Supreme Court has been adjusted. You refuse to run for the legislature. Because
admittedly, it's a tough life in these times. How do you expect the law to be able to prevail if we can't get people who are committed to run for the legislature?
Well, I think that the first thing that we have to have is we have to have kick-ass populists. We've got to get somebody on the ground that's willing to go out and risk themselves to be a case. If being with the experience I've had of running for Congress, working on Capitol Hill, doing what I do today, if somebody walked up to me today and said, "I will give you a seat in the United States House of Representatives, just walk in, you don't have to run for office, just walk up," and I wouldn't even take it. I believe that I can affect more people today with what I'm doing than talking to them about committing their life than anything that I could individually do in those areas. Will I say to everybody else, you ought to do what I'm doing? No. But I'm going to say to you, do what your heart is singing. if you follow your heart, you will have the greatest opportunity in life. And you're all here to become lawyers. You know, we can talk about all the lousy lawyer jokes. I got 1,000 of them. But the fact of it is, this is the area that we have. One of those old conservative Supreme Court justices just may die. We just may end up with a new appointment, much like the last one we got. And I'll tell you what, I totally agree with her, that somebody in Harlem living life probably has more experience than somebody that's on the Supreme Court. So I'm not saying that we don't want to change the Supreme Court. I'm not saying that we should not elect good people. But I believe right now there is more hope under law than we have anywhere else that's out there. Congress today is bought and paid for. Senator Breaux made an amazing statement. He said, "I cannot be bought, but I can be rented." We have the best government money can buy. Let's go and make sure that we have a law for all of the people.
Just one quick follow-up question. The Patriot, that aspect of the Patriot Act has not yet been tried on a First Amendment argument, has
nope.
it?
No. Nope. Okay. And the amazing thing is, I don't think they want to try it.
No,
they did
so
not
either.
Want the food disparagement case in court. I'm sure they don't want the Animal Enterprise Terrorist Act into court. But this is not about invoking the law. It's about scaring the hell out of every television station, every radio station, every newspaper. And don't kid yourself, the Oprah show, it ended up chilling all of the discussion about the food that we eat. They did not spill those millions of dollars in vain. Question.
How long did Oprah stick with her?
The what?
How long did Oprah stick with her no beef statement?
As far as I know, Oprah does not eat beef today. I do know that she eats fish and chicken. I know that to be a fact. But as far as I know, every time I've been around her, she has not eaten pork or beef. And I will tell you that I think Oprah is one of the finest people that I've ever met in my life. I can still remember when we were sitting there discussing the case and Oprah was saying, "I just don't understand why these people want to sue me. I'm a good person." And Dr. Phil looked at her and said, "Knock that off." We're here, we're now, it's up to us now to win the case. And I will tell you, Dr. Phil was extremely expensive, but he was worth every penny of it because he is the one that came up with the idea that everybody wanted to defend the case on the facts. He says, if we defend this case on the facts, we'll bring in our experts. They'll bring in the people from Texas A&M, and the jury won't know who to believe. Said, we need to defend the case on the right of free speech. Every juror sitting over there does not want to lose their right of free speech. That's why we won the case. We're about to the end of the hour. Thank you very much.